Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode, and today I am joined by Curtis Powell. Now, Curtis is a social worker. I know some people are going to think, but Curtis is actually genuinely, I asked Curtis to come on because I've been watching his videos and he is quite well informed of domestic abuse and the right and the wrong way to approach situations when they are still a victim, still living, victim and the children still living with the perpetrator. He, you know, and that was kind of, you know, a breath of fresh air for me, because certainly from my experience, that didn't happen. And I know for many people, Curtis, that it doesn't happen at all, does it?
Yeah, it's for me probably, if not one of the top two most complex issues I find in children and family social work.
I mean, it isn't as simple as just leaving. You cannot just leave, you know. It's a process that has to be, you know, planned out very, very carefully. I mean, I know in my, I say to professionals, I've got a free resource actually, and within that I have actually said that, you know, if professionals are aware that there is domestic abuse taking place, there I would advise them to contact the police and ask them to facilitate a safe exit. But that requires the professionals that have said that this needs to happen to be able to articulate why there is risk for the police to take that more seriously. So it's, you know, but I have known a situation. In fact, it's a friend of mine, actually. She was very, very fortunate that an officer there was two officers. One had like kind of been very dismissive, and the other one was like, well, what are you going to do now? She was like, well, I've got to go back. He said, you're not going. If you go back, you're in danger. He says, I'm going to come with you. I'm going to wait while you get your things together, and I will make sure that you leave safely. Mm-hmm. And she said, thank God he did, because when I got back, he was very drunk. She said that wouldn't, she knows that would have gone down. And even he says, thank God I've come with you, because that wouldn't have ended well. When he realised you were going to leave. So we need more situations like that, where, because it does increase tenfold.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example of where I'm coming from, because where the police stand and where we stand are in slightly different positions. And we have a type of work to do, which is different from the police. Mm. So from my position as a social worker, sorry, I did forget to say thanks for having me on. So my position as a social worker, I'm in the position of making sure that when I go to bed, I've done what's necessary.
Yeah.
And hope that, this is sad, but this is true from where I am. I hope that when I wake up in the morning, everyone's still alive.
Yes.
So, you know, the worst thing is that, you know, we don't want to wake up and find that, oh, someone's died, because I was trying not to scare someone, right? Because people have fear.
Yeah.
But in my previous role, I was an assistant team manager or deputy, whatever you want to call it. And it was, I allocated cases. And whenever you read the referral from the MASH team, you're trying to assess from just paper what's going on and how best to approach. So let's say it's an allegation of domestic abuse, or an anonymous report has come through of screaming and banging and so forth. Do we just go up to the house and just knock on the door? And if you do that, are you creating more risk by doing that? And if the parent says, no, nothing's happened. I've been in that position a number of times. And so when I'm allocating certain cases, I send a message to the social worker because we just email out the information and allocate a case in the in-house system. And then I say to them, call me before you make contact because we want to strategize given the information that we have. And then we have to plan, do we meet the parent at school? Do we meet them at the library, at the cafe? Is there a level of disguise compliance? Are we navigating their fears? And all these things have to be juggled. But at the same time, then sometimes needs to be immediate action. And sometimes the parents also, it's okay, I know you know what I'm talking about. So you're thinking, as a social worker, do I try to save a family? And in my attempt to save a family, will it meet resistance and create more risk? And whose head will it be on? All of this.
Exactly. And I always take the same approach when I'm evaluating risk with a victim. Let's say I've done a detailed timeline. I've established that the perpetrating party has been very, very sneaky, underhanded, been very careful to make sure that there's no evidence to support what's taken place. But perhaps the perpetrator has gained evidence of a reactive response that they have initiated out the victim. So in that situation, reporting to the police not only increases the risk from as far as the perpetrator is concerned, but it also potentially puts the victim under scrutiny, under suspicion as the perpetrator, as opposed to being the victim. So in that situation, what I always advise is, if you are able to secure safety first before calling the police, do so. Because what we don't want is a situation where you reach out to the police, there's more evidence to suggest that you are the problem and not the actual perpetrating party, and they don't take action. They completely dismiss it, they minimize it, and they brush it under the carpet. By you reporting, you've already increased your risk tenfold. And that's what we want to avoid. So, is there a way for you to exit safely before contacting the police? Because then it's an easier, because they will try to gain back control. There's no way, no way of avoiding it. They will always try to regain back control when the victim leaves. So you've got a higher chance of them revealing their cards at that point, and at which point then that becomes a stalking offence as opposed to coercive control, which is an easier crime to get over the line than it is coercive control, because all we have to prove is that that is unwanted behaviour, and that if that behaviour is causing you to feel intimidated and impact how you go about your life. Well, we only need two or more incidences where the perpetrator is very aware that behaviour is not wanted to open up an investigation. So it becomes an easier crime to get over the line. You now suddenly have evidence of that behaviour. So then, when you present a detailed timeline that you may not have evidence to back up, the fact that they have engaged in the behaviour they have post-separation would back up what you're saying and make it more credible to support any evidence that there is for the reactive responses.
Well, going back to the earlier question of is there a way to make a safe exit without notifying the police? Now, generally, we don't have to always involve the police. And this is where, and the perpetrators are like 85% male. So this is a lot of the time where dads will be, there's a lot of saying that there's a lot of injustice because it's not true what she's saying, for example.
Yes, yeah.
So what we do is it's not about establishing the truth at first. It's about establishing safety.
Exactly.
So what we do is we'll say, if we do make contact with a victim, we'll say, you need to demonstrate, and this is the social services position where people get scared. You need to demonstrate that you're willing to work with us, given what you said, you've been physically abused. There's a risk of harm to you and the children. You need to demonstrate that you can act appropriately to safeguard the child. Because we are the child social worker, not the parent social worker. Although we work with you both, our priority is the child. So if we're in a position where we can say, and believe me, I've been in this so many times, we have to say, what do you want to do? Are you staying in the home, or are you going to go where we suggest you go? And that could be to family, friends, or a refuge. So at this stage, we don't necessarily need to call the police. And then what happens sometimes is the mom might say, I'm going to a refuge, or I'm going to my mom's. Fine. Once we know that she can get out, and how we support that can vary.
I was going to say, how do you support that to make
It depends, because she might say, look, he's at work, I can go now.
Yeah.
Or I need help getting down here, I don't have a car. I'll see you at the house. It just depends. Or meet me down the road. Or call the police. The vast majority of times we've had these types of cases, it's not a need for the police, it's a need for the parent to act. But if we think that there's significant harm, I don't work in MASH. MASH might say this needs a strategy meeting, we need the police involved. But I found that most of the time it's a matter of strategizing how to get out safely. Now, as in my experience working with the police have a special division that deal with domestic abuse cases, and they're quite sensitive about how they manage that. Now, I say that's my experience. So what they don't usually do, in my experience, is rush in. But I have been told many stories. And
Yes.
rushing in does create a situation. Now, what it does is it creates a situation sometimes where the parent now has to make that choice. Because once the police are there, they're safe as long as they make certain choices.
Well, this is the thing. So when the police turn up, it is, so let's say they've been notified because, I don't know, a neighbor's heard banging, shouting, screaming, crying. They turn up and a victim is automatic. It can be as little as a look, a tone of voice, and that is enough of a message to the victim to say, do not step out of line. You step out of line, you know what the consequences will be. So they automatically go into, remember, they are conditioned to hide. It becomes a default. It's like a switch. You can switch it on and we can switch it off. And this is where it's harder to articulate and explain our fear. Because if we've done a sterling job at putting on a front, making out that everything's okay. Oh, no, it was just it was nothing. It was actually my fault. I upset him. I woke him up, when he was asleep, and maybe he's been working nights, and I should have kept the kids quiet. It was my fault. You automatically, you're conditioned to take the blame. You're conditioned to make excuses for them because if it's not taken seriously by the police, the consequences are going to be major. I mean, when I called 999, I automatically said, no, I'd called 999 it was an impulsive thing. It was not something that I thought through. It was like I've reached breaking point. I rung 999. So at that point, there was no going back. I'd already done it. Officer came out, and I was showing her the evidence, and she was like, right, I need to pass this over to GMP. And right. I said, but I don't want him arrested. I just want the abuse to stop. Now, that's a common thing that victims will say. just want the abuse because they're fearful if it's not taken seriously, if there's no consequences, they know, and it might not be a conscious thing that they know. It's known on a nervous system level from those seeds of uncertainty that are planted very, very early on in the relationship. They're watered over time. We know that if this isn't taken seriously, and I've got to send the police out. I am not, this is not going to go down well at all. I'm going to pay the price for this. So I automatically said, oh no, I don't want to press charges. I just want the abuse to stop. I just want somebody to go and talk just to stop it. But even that in itself would have caused me a problem. Now, she did say to me, she said, look, I will communicate this, but don't be surprised if they look at the evidence and they say it's too serious to ignore. And that's exactly what happened. The sergeant looked at the evidence and he said, it's too serious to ignore. They went out. They actually asked him to come in for a voluntary interview at that point. They told him not to communicate with me. Well, what did he do? Of course, he communicated with me, didn't he? So then he got arrested. Now, at that point, I knew there was no going back. I knew that, well, but again, other people don't think the same way. I did, fortunately. But I knew that now that he'd been arrested and I'd made such an example out of him, if I would suffer the price for it. So I knew I had to put those wheels in motion for the divorce. I had to finalize everything. I had to go no contact. I had to cut it all dead because I was fearful of talking to him because I knew if I'd spoken to him, he would have made me feel bad and he may have persuaded me to go back to him, and I would have done. I know I would have done. I know that if I hadn't have done what I did, and that's why I always say no contact is absolutely crucial. They are Oscar-winning performers when it comes to winning over. I mean, they can win over people, the average person, but they can also win over their victim very, very easily. And they do it very well. They do it very well. So we're just going to break for a short interval and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with a skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So before the break, we were just talking about how challenging it is to leave a perpetrator, no matter how scared you are.
Yeah, it is complex. I mean, this is it. I mean, the social services, they're in a position where they have a remit of work.
Yeah.
And a window to operate. And I'm going to give you a quick story. But the window, before I give you the story, the window to operate, again, going back to the original point I made, I have a certain amount of time to do what I'm doing. And I have to demonstrate not only to the family, but to people above me that I take an appropriate action. And this scenario may have different levels of risk according to who's reading it. So I have to satisfy not just the situation, but people around me to say, I'm doing what's right here. So I'll give you an example. I had this referral that came through. A parent had gone to the police and reported that she was being abused by her partner. She got two very, very young children, not older than five. And she said to the police that I'm being abused. Now, she said, I don't want you to do anything. So you do understand at that point, the police's hands are also tied because it requires compliance from the parent. So she says, I don't want anything done for various reasons. I just want him to stop. That's the second
Exactly what
call,
I said.
right? That's the second call to the police, right? And so the police didn't do anything because she wasn't going to do anything. So then they let us know. And I have a certain time frame to do this assessment. Somebody will be saying to me, Curtis, what's going on with this family? It's been a month now. There was no response from the parent. So it's coming up to that point where I have to do this assessment. I need to make contact. And what I needed to do as a social worker is I need to go in the home and have a look. I need to see everyone's face. I need to see the children to see if they're safe. What can I pick up from their environment? Now, this is the thing. No response. So I managed to get hold of the nursery. Now, understand this complexity. I need consent from the parent to make contact with anybody because it's under Section 17 of the Children's Act. I can't just share information. So I'm in a situation where if I go to the home and he's there, I'm exposing the family. And if I break the law and try to make contact with other agencies, the parent could complain and it could be a real problem for me. So I called the school anyway and gave them very limited the nursery very limited information, and I said, let's prepare to pull mum to the nursery, but mum didn't want to do it. So what I had to do is I had to go to the home. I'm thinking, look, is there further harm taking place? I went to the home, and who answered the door?
Dad.
Mum.
Oh,
No, and then dad came.
Mom.
So she said, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, look, I've got this report here. Then he comes, he says, what's the problem? And she stood behind him and was giving me a sign, just the vaguest of signs to say, no. So I had to lie to everybody. And then I said, look, let me come in, let's have a chat. And I said, if I can speak to you all individually, that would be great. He was very compliant. She was very compliant. Then I took her in a room and then she said to me in whisper, it's happening, but it's okay now.
Which is, it's not.
I don't want to leave. He's not hurting me. He's done it a few times before. And it wasn't just him, it was the other family members as well. One other family, sorry, member. So the situation was this. She will not comply. The children didn't look harmed. They looked really happy. I'm good at assessing behavior. I'm of the opinion that children were happy and safe, and it was more about the parents. So in that situation, I can't enforce anything. It didn't quite meet a threshold for us to intervene on a statutory basis. I have to walk away. But I gave mum, this is where we need to go in the future. The problem is, will she take that course of action? So, you're looking at now, for example, when the World Cup happens or the Euros happen, the DV rate goes up to 70%, twice the amount, two, three times the amount of children and women are dying in that period, just in the UK. And then we've got another complexity is that a number of cases that I've had, it's the parent telling, giving a false account of abuse in order to get housing. And so I've learned this, right? It's so complex. So I've learned this. Let's get you safe. You're going to have to go to court now because I'm not here to try and prove who's telling the truth. let that happen with the police, let that happen with the courts. But you have to understand, parent, if this is happening, I understand you're scared, but you need to show us that you will do the right thing if you're in danger. And it's not easy, because I remember doing some training years ago, and it says that victims will take on average 37 attempts to leave before they actually do.
Yeah, but that's because there's a whole host of reasons why. I know for me it was I did not want to be a single mum. I did not want to be a single mum. And a lot of the time, I know with my ex, he would say to me, nobody's going to want a single mum with baggage.
Yeah.
And that sits deep with you.
Yeah.
And then, because it's not always bad, this is the thing. It's not always bad, and that if it was consistently bad, that's an indecision. The abuse. So if the treatment that you get from the abusive party is if it was consistently like that, well, that's an easy decision. Mm. But when it is
a range of behaviours.
Yeah, and you when it's good, you cling on to that for dear life, and it's like you switch off from the bad. It's like the bad does not exist. You shut it out until it comes back around again. The cycle comes back around again. Now I can comment on that from an adult perspective, being in an abusive relationship, and as a child. Now, if you were to ask me as a child, unless there was an escalation in behaviour from my abusive parents, I would say that I had a great childhood. Anybody who met us would think that we were the perfect family unit. Believe me, behind closed doors was a different story entirely. And the perception that I and my siblings gave was, again, that everything, we was a picture perfect family.
Yeah.
It was far from the truth.
Yeah.
If the reality is, I grew up in a war zone. I grew up in a war zone. I mean, there was many a time that there was a couple of occasions when I pretty much saved my dad's, my mum's life. It was always when my dad was turning up from working away. Could I prove it? That it was, no, of course I couldn't prove it, but it was too convenient. I know some horrific things that happened to her. Horrific things. So, you know, when you've grown up in that, I understand it from a child's perspective. So just because a child seems happy and okay, they could actually be dropping into Stockholm response. And because I can totally relate to that, totally relate to it. I mean, I remember my dad saying to me, "Oh, you know, I must thank you. You know, you always stuck up for me. You know, when your mum was kicking off." And you don't get it, do you? You don't understand. You think I was on your side? No, I was micromanaging escalation, because I knew if I didn't, I'd get the same treatment. I knew that, so. You become, it's, Stockholm response is very, very real with children, very real. So there's so many moving parts to it. You know, again, they can mirror the behavior to, as a way of, well, if I abuse mum, for example, because dad is, well, maybe he won't do it to me. So they do it as a, it, there's so, there is so many moves, so complex.
This is why I said earlier on, it's probably the most complex type of case. Because I found in reality, there isn't a one way to deal with it. There isn't a just get the police to do this or put in this system. At the end of the day, you've got to convince the victim to take a certain action. Their lives and the lives of their children. And that's not easy. That's not a one size fits all. That is something that you have to strategize around. I've met largely great police officers who know how to do that and work with that. And at times when there's been cases of abuse, they've allowed me to lead for the most part. I'm making appeals to the parent to tell the truth because the evidence is strong. I don't want to escalate it. Make the right decision today because it's good. We've got enough evidence for worry. You need to make a decision or we're going to and we don't want that. And parents are scared. And especially when it's a Section 47, where we're there in their house or we've got them at school because of a disclosure from the child. That is one of the tightest situations. And we have no idea how it's going to play out. And we're trying to urge situations. And it's sadly when some parents, sadly, are prepared to allow their children to be taken because the only thing, I've got this saying, I'd rather be hurt than be alone. Do you know what I mean by that? Because the safest thing is...
Because that represents more pain, that means it represents emotional danger than the physical danger. And this is the crazy part of it. It's not the incident that's a problem. It is the emotion that's the problem. That's what represents the greatest danger. So if being alone represents a greater pain, it's safer to the nervous system to stay with the person who is putting you in physical arm's way.
I see it time and time again. And to convince someone that being alone is the safest space for you right now is probably one of the toughest discussions, most complicated discussions and frustrating discussions to have. How do you convince someone?
Yeah.
Kate, you've been through it, right? It took you a number.
Absolutely. And honestly, I can tell you it takes an awful lot of work on yourself to overcome that. Because even post-separation, this is why you see time and time again, when they don't do the work on themselves, they will jump from one abusive relationship to another abusive relationship. And the cycle keeps continuing because they have the thought of being alone is unbearable. Now, I can totally relate to that. I mean, I think I'd been separated from my ex. Well, I'd been filed for divorce about, I don't know, I think it was about 18 months before I went on the dating sites. And I did. I went through a series of dates and now I'm like, do you know what? I would genuinely rather be on my own. But it took me quite a long time to get to that point where, unless it's right, I am not interested. Genuinely, I'm not interested. It's not worth... it's not worth the disruption that it causes to the children, because unless you can guarantee that this is going to be right, the danger you put your children in, even from an emotional perspective, is just not worth it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Something I was going to say earlier on was, I always think, and I've heard it from mothers and fathers, if social services took action when I was a kid, I wouldn't be who I am now. But they failed to act.
Well, yeah. Same as me.
Now, back then, I mean, obviously, when you was a child, social services has come a long way. There was a lot less awareness and a lot more stereotypes in society. So you were on your back foot already for social services. And the police had attitudes that probably haven't evolved to what they are now.
Yeah.
But what we can say is it's still difficult, but you're looking back and you're like, I wish somebody just dragged us out of that situation now. And that could have ended all of the generational issues.
Yeah. And that's what it is. It's always a generational cycle. It's always a generational cycle. And it takes one person to break it for your children and the next generation.
Yeah, you mentioned something earlier. I think we was off on when we were before we prior to recording. You know that there's a lot of, I interact in various lives on social media with parents who are afraid of social services or are disgruntled, have a hatred for, say, and I hear a lot of people say they came in and took my kids for no reason. And this is where it gets difficult, is because some families have a pattern, like you said, from one abusive relationship to another. And if that pattern isn't broken, either someone is going to die or that will be repeated in the children.
100%.
And so it's never for no reason. I don't get me wrong, I think some injustice has happened in social services and the police, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about, and I remember posting this about a year ago, even though it's hard, even though it might feel impossible, everyone needs to be accountable. It's not that parents hate their children or don't care. It's not that parents, it's not even, we struggle to put our children first sometimes, and we struggle to make the right decision, because when you're in fear, when you're under pressure, when you've been trained and groomed, you really can't make the best decisions. This is humanity. So I expect parents to struggle. I'm sitting there thinking, back in the day when I was more ignorant, I'd look at families and think, why don't you just get out? If you're smoking and you're going to get cancer, just stop. Why would you take drugs? They're going to take your kids. I work with drug addicted children, families all the time. And I know at the end of the day, as much as I see comments filling up in the feed,
Not as easy as that, because it goes back to the underlying root cause, the wound. What's that? What are the drugs? What's the drink? What's it soothing? It's soothing something. So what's the landscape presenting as to trigger that wound? We're just
still
going
there.
to break for a short interval, and we'll see you after.
The station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato. Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So yeah, I mean there is so much, there's so much to consider there though, isn't there, in regards to the generational cycles that we need to break. And it is about It is a, and this is what I always find, is that when people, when I talk about childhood trauma, people automatically think growing up in a war zone. That's what they automatically think. And unfortunately, that's not just what it is. Yeah, okay, that's the extreme end of it, but it literally can be an emotional disconnect between parent and child that can cause childhood trauma. And if you have grown up in a had a poor upbringing yourself, where you felt emotionally unsafe, then unfortunately, if you've not done the work on yourself, you are regardless of how hard you think you are, you know, working to make sure that you don't, your child doesn't have the same upbringing as you did, just because of your emotional state and the coping mechanisms that you've developed as a result of that, that will have an impact on your children. So, you know, if you are, I mean, I was just chatting to a friend of mine who's a therapist this morning, because she sent me across an article. She said, oh, you need to have a look at this. We started talking about that. And, you know, it can be mum and dad are just busy. Say they are, I don't know, let's say they've had a pressure on them from kids to be successful, and they find their worth in their success. They can put so much emphasis and effort into their career, which means that they are not emotionally present with their children. And although in their head they think, I'm doing it for their good, I'm doing it to give them this is what pays for this big house, this was what pays for the private school, this is what pays for, you know, keeps the food on the table. And although that, you know, to a degree, obviously some of those things are important, but if it means your children feel that they are emotionally disregarded, not important, invisible, unloved. And that is the story. These are stories we create in our own mind. I mean, I don't know whether you've watched Adolescence, but that was a prime example, you know, a visual that people could relate to. That's why I'm bringing this one up. So Jamie had created, there was a clear emotional disconnect. His dad obviously had a very turbulent childhood where he was physically beaten by his dad. And he thought, well, I'm not doing the same thing. And he may not have been beating Jamie, but because of his emotional wounds that were still there and he'd not dealt with, that was resulting in how he was showing up within his family, within the family unit. And, you know, he recalled a time when, you know, he felt he wanted his dad to defend him at a football match, and his dad didn't defend him, didn't have his back. And he felt he was constantly chasing his dad's approval, his dad's protection, his dad's love and recognition. And that's what it can lead to. So it's not necessarily that you are somebody is an abusive parent from in the extreme ends of things. It could literally be that. It could literally be an emotional disconnect, and the child has developed its own story attached to that. As, well, I'm not good enough. This is my fault. This is all because of me. I'm not lovable. Nobody wants me. In Jamie's case, I'm ugly. And of course, when he went into the school environment, that story that he'd created, and that's a story he'd created in his own head. Nobody had told him that story. And it was reinforced with the way certain children were behaving towards him in the school environment. So that shone a great big spotlight on that wound that rooted back to the emotional disconnect between parent and child. And this is where that generational cycle, despite how hard people think they are at making sure, working to make sure that their child doesn't have the same horrific childhood that they had, you could still be. Without even realizing it. It's not an intentional thing that people, you know, parents do, but unless you've got an awareness of it, I mean, I've got an awareness of it. As a sole parent doing everything on my own, I've got nobody to fall back on. I've got nobody to share the load with. So I know I can sometimes zone out, be emotionally detached or distant. Detached is the wrong word, distant from my daughter. And she'll be like, but mummy, I want you to watch a movie with me. Oh, but baby, I just need to get this done. Just let mummy get this done and then we'll do it. Now, because she's grown up in an environment where false promises have been made by her dad that were never materials, that were just like, you know, the dangling carrots to keep you hooked and, you know, it was never, ever going to be delivered. everything has to be right now with my daughter. So if I'm saying, just let mommy's just got to do this, that adds to her feeling of abandonment. So that's something I have to be very, very mindful of. And I sometimes do take my eye off the ball with it, but then I quickly clock it and I pull myself back. So I'm like, no, actually, that can wait now. Yes, well, okay, let's watch a movie, darling. What movie do you want to watch? Let's have a movie night. So it's without that awareness, you don't pull yourself back from it. You don't clock it. And a lot of parents don't have that awareness. This is the problem. And it is something that every single parent can be guilty of doing, because at the end of the day, we all have responsibilities. We all are juggling a million balls, particularly in the world that we're living in at the moment. You know, it can be easily done. So without that awareness, we can be impacting our children, and they can be creating these little stories in their head that are really damaging. And that's just purely from a feeling. But you see, as an adult, that child can look back and think with a rational head and say, well, of course I didn't have a bad childhood. Of course mum and dad were just doing their best to give us a good life. You know, I understand that now as an adult. But as a child, you don't get that. You don't see that as a child. All you see is, well, I just want to have fun. I just want to have a nice time. And I don't feel important. That's all that child sees. So when we talk about childhood trauma, it can be something like that. And when you have a single parent household, and I know there's a lot of emphasis on, people will blame the rise in youth offending, crimes and violence on single parent households, and particularly target the blame at the mother. And that's a little bit unfair, because you've got to look at the conditions that sole parent is dealing with. They are firefighting. They are constantly in survival, potentially. And if you add another layer onto that, where the child is maybe displaying undesirable behaviours, maybe being aggressive towards them, that is triggering their nervous system, because their nervous system will say, I'm under attack, and that will compound that problem. So when there's that distance, the child's going to seek external belonging from the wrong crowds, from the wrong groups, and that's where they end up going down a path. It all roots back to, we need emotional safety and connection with our caregivers. That's what it all roots back to. Without that, we haven't got a good start in life without that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think it's around 70% of our referrals come from single parent homes.
Yeah.
I don't think all the blame should sit on one of the parents. Two parents owe the child.
Exactly.
I also think that as a parent, one of our priorities is to prepare our children to be productive in the future.
I agree.
And whether you're a single parent or not, because again, we can all come from a two-parent home and it can be a real chaos. So I think that we have to teach our children how to be resilient emotionally, how to understand boundaries, how to regulate, how to take the highs and the lows.
Yeah.
That can easily be neglected, especially when there's social media and you've got the pressures of, well, now one parent has to go to work and then the child is neglected. There is a level of neglect, and we all experience that. But some of us, the majority of us have that resilience and that fortitude to be productive despite. But one thing that sticks out, and I've been asked by so many people to do a response review to adolescence. It was episode 4, and I'll do it. I'll do a fuller version. They gave us the clues. There were behaviors that they saw in the young man that they chose not to deal with. And it just shows you that it's not just about the two or one parent home thing. It's just about seeing as a parent what's going on.
Yeah. And,
you know, letting the kid out. There was a real disconnect, not only for dad, but for mum as well. We didn't get a much insight into mum.
It wasn't much about mum at all, was there? No, there was definitely an element of mum was a little bit of a doormat, treated disrespectfully. And again, that will root back to his volatile, the dad's volatile attitude.
Yeah, he, young boy, Jamie, he displayed a lot of worrying behaviors, or even probably just one particularly worrying behavior. Neither parent addressed it.
No.
So what we're looking at now is a young man who, and look, he's actually much more advanced. He's in the future now, an abuser, stroke murderer. And I'm saying to parents, if you see a behavior that is worrying, do something about it. Call early help, call a therapist, call a mentor, do something, but don't think you can just wish it away or hope it's just a phase. I'd be worried.
We're just going to end this episode here and we're going to continue next week with Curtis, where we will continue this conversation.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls, and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specializing in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.